The story of Desert Island Discs, just as a brief congregational poll, how many of you are aware of this radio program? So this was actually a good idea, Gretchen, to explain Desert Island Discs.
Yes, well, before Mark sent this to me, I was in amongst most of your company as well, never having heard of it either. It turns out that Desert Island Discs is a biographical and factual radio program broadcast on BBC Radio 4. It was first broadcast the 29th of January, 1942, and so celebrated its 70th anniversary in 2012. It was devised and originally presented by Roy Plomley. So on the program, guests are invited to imagine themselves cast away on a desert island, Desert Island Discs, get it? And then they are instructed to choose 8 pieces of music, originally gramophone records. Do you know what those are? I didn't. Mark told me though. So they choose these 8 pieces of music that they will bring with them, and the discussion of their choices permits a review of their life. Excerpts from their choices are then played, or in the cases of really short pieces, the whole thing. At the end of the program, they choose the piece that the one that they regard most highly. And then they are also asked which book they would take with them. And they are automatically given the complete works of Shakespeare, and either the Bible or some other appropriate religious or philosophical book. Guests can also choose one luxury item, which must be inanimate and of no use in escaping the island or in allowing communication from outside, which there went my whole, oh, I would bring an iPhone idea. Roy Plomley enforced the rules strictly, but they're less strictly enforced today. So, for example, Plomley would not allow his guests to take another human being with them to the island. But under the rule of a later host, John Cleese was allowed to take Michael Palin with him on the condition that he was dead and stuffed. Examples of luxuries have included champagne and a piano, the latter of which is actually one of the most requested luxuries. The most requested music over the first 60 years, I should make you guess, but I'll tell you, it was Ode to Joy, the last movement of Beethoven's Ninth Symphony. So now you and we know.
Very good, Gretchen. Thank you very much. So, when we marry, music plays. We first meet and we find our song. And if we break up, we find our breakup song. There is music of our childhood and there is music of our children's childhood. For a few years, Rafi was our son David's favorite musician. And by extension, he became Vicky and my favorite musician as well. In fact, there are certain Rafi songs which immediately transport me back to David's room in the quiet of the evening at 130 Marshall Street, the parsonage of the First Parish of Watertown, Massachusetts, bedtime 24 years ago. Music makes us laugh, cry, dance, move, sway, swing, and enjoy romantic interludes. Long before his great novel Les Miserables was transformed into a musical, Victor Hugo wrote, "Music expresses that which cannot be said and on which it is impossible to remain silent." It is this interface between the music we love and the lives we live that has provided the inspiration for Desert Island Discs and made it still popular after 70 years. All kinds of guests have gathered as castaways. Paul McCartney, one. Archbishop Desmond Tutu, J.K. Rowling, a lot of people from every walk of life and all ages. And the musical choices, those eight, well, see, when Gretchen doesn't know what a gramophone record is, I'm just reminded of the fact, which comes to me every now and then, that I've been a UU minister longer than she's been alive. So the premise, very simple. You choose those eight musical pieces. One perceptive critic remarked that the title would better be Deserted Island Discs. But you might wonder, what eight choices would yours be? And what book, beyond the religious or philosophical work, would you take? And what luxury item? Now, based on the laughter at the first service and this service, I have to believe that we have a lot of Monty Python fans in this congregation, because you didn't have any trouble recognizing John Cleese or Michael Palin. So of the hundreds and hundreds of castaways based on more than a 70-year history, I've chosen two. J.K. Rowling, the author, of course, of the Harry Potter books, and some books since then. The Casual Vacancy is one, but she's written another book, a mystery book, under a pseudonym. And that mystery book, very interesting, I'm sorry I don't remember the name right now, got rave reviews. And she should really be proud, because it wasn't for some time until somebody blew her cover and indicated that it was, in fact, J.K. Rowling who wrote the adult mystery. Among her musical choices were Come Together by the Beatles. I grew up listening to them, she said. Tchaikovsky's Violin Concerto in D Major, the first movement. It just has this very strong association of me writing and swelling and then becoming a mother. Everybody Hurts by R.E.M., Guilt by Marianne Faithfull, All Along the Watchtower, Jimi Hendrix, and finally, Mozart, Agnus Dei from Requiem in D minor, probably my favorite piece of music in the world. And her luxury item would be pen and unlimited paper, as befits a writer. The musical choices are always interesting to me because they cover a wide territory. Almost always there will be some classical pieces, but frequently rock, pop, rhythm and blues, a tremendous collection of variety. My second choice was Archbishop Desmond Tutu. He was, of course, a guest on the show, and he talked about the fact that his family was living in Johannesburg when he first encountered one of the great figures of the anti-apartheid movement. Tutu's mother was a cleaner and a cook at a local home for blind women. And the local parish priest was Trevor Huddleston, a British clergyman well known as a vociferous opponent of apartheid. Desmond and his mother were standing on the veranda of the hostel when this tall priest with a flowing cassock swept past. He was wearing a big black hat, and he doffed his hat to my mother. That was mind-blowing for me, a white man greeting my mother with courtesy. One of his musical choices was Glenn Miller's In the Mood, which brings out perhaps a different side of him. He said, I can just still picture in my mind's eye the jukeboxes that we had in a number of the stores in our townships. And I can just see all these young people. I was amongst them, jiving away like crazy on the stoop on the veranda of the store. Well, before we go further, you might well ask the question that I asked of myself, why this sermon theme for Thanksgiving 2013? Well, one way I can talk about it is to contrast something. When Vicki and I lived in Watertown, Mass., and before we had children, One memorable Thanksgiving, we attended services at the Unitarian Congregation in Plymouth, Massachusetts. So we saw Plymouth Rock, and we saw a parade of folks dressed in pilgrim garb, On the outskirts of town was a national day of mourning still carried out by descendants of the original Wampanoag tribe. It was very intense, but not all of us live in New England. And as we live in different parts of the country, then it seems true that the Pilgrims, Plymouth Rock, the Wampanoag tribe, the Mule in the Wilderness now feel remote from us in time and space. And Thanksgiving is getting more and more pressure from Halloween on the one hand and Christmas on the other. It might just disappear someday. But this archetypal act of giving thanks for those things that we truly treasure and those experiences that contribute to our well-being and perhaps even our survival, those remain eternally present in our lives. And for all of us, for our kids, grandkids, for we ourselves, whatever our age, there is the need to cultivate that part of us that is still capable of being thankful and giving thanks. And so I would list music as among our greatest treasures. And partly I can say that because I see the response Sunday after Sunday and for the last few years to Ryan Marvel's music in this congregation. I see what happens with our choir. I see what happens when he plays and leads music here. It's a transformative experience, and I hear from people in this congregation again and again how important this music is to them as part of the service. Maya Angelou said, "Music was my refuge. I could crawl into the spaces between the notes and curl my back to my loneliness." Ray Charles said, "I was born with music inside me. Music was one of my parts, like my ribs, my kidneys, my liver, my heart, like my blood. It was a force already within me when I arrived on the scene. It was a necessity for me, like food or water." And even for those of us who don't play an instrument or who don't play it well, I think listening to music, which we can do more readily and more easily than ever before, is an important part of our lives. Even gruff, iconoclastic philosopher Friedrich Nietzsche said, "Without music, life would be a mistake." So now for a thematic shift and also to try to support what I've said so far. Singer Glenn Campbell is performing, and he just finishes his great piece, Galveston. And his next piece on the performance is Galveston. So his family members who are with him on stage chuckle and then remind him that he's just sung that piece. Glenn Campbell was diagnosed with Alzheimer's in 2011, but he performs whenever he can. The Alzheimer's Association, in its December 2011 newsletter, wrote, "Whatever else Alzheimer's may have done to this 75-year-old entertainer, it hasn't affected his voice or his gorgeous guitar solos." So what makes that possible? Music has evocative and mnemonic power in patients with Alzheimer's disease, which can give access to lost powers and lost identity, an access which cannot be provided by anything else. That's neurologist Oliver Sacks, who has written about the importance of music in our lives and in the lives of those dealing with Alzheimer's and dementia. Much study has gone into the impact of music on people with dementia. We make memories in the medial temporal lobes of our brains, such as the hippocampus, and these are the first parts to be ravaged as Alzheimer's develops. By contrast, music pulls from the relatively unscathed cortical and subcortical areas, and so it is, in that regard, protected. So what happens with Alzheimer patients? The music brings them not only to the present, not only in some sense wakes them up, but also transports them back to their identity, to their past, to themselves. In our congregation, we have someone who works with both music and memory. Sarah Johnson was here with us at the first service, and I told Sarah the reason I wanted to talk about her work very briefly is because we have a member of our congregation who is truly a recognized expert in this field. Sarah is the neurologic music therapist for the inpatient rehabilitation and outpatient children's therapy services of Poudre Valley Hospital. She created these programs over 20 years ago. She's facilitated a music therapy internship at PVH since 2000. She's the clinical supervisor for the graduate music therapy students at Colorado State. She co-coordinates the community outreach program of the Center for Biomedical Research in Music. In addition, she assists with the international training institutes and fellowship training in neurologic music therapy, and she's presented on her clinical work in neurologic music at state, regional, and national levels, as well as Canada, Japan, and South Korea. She was awarded the Professional Practice Award by the American Music Therapy Association, and she said, "I view my work as a neurologic music therapist as an ongoing opportunity to blend creativity, musical skills, flexibility, and academic challenge. I can't think of a better way to have spent my professional life." I know very well that if any of you would like to have a conversation with Sarah about a loved one, about bringing music therapy into a loved one's life, then she would be very happy to have that conversation with you. I think we can say that music is therapy. It is solace in our sorrow and joy in our hearts. It's the beat in our step and the rhythm of our journey. Thanks to researchers and professionals, we're learning more about the significance of music in our lives and in our brains. Songs may come and go, but some linger in our lives as long as we draw breath. And what I've noticed over the last few years officiating at memorial services is that music is becoming more and more important. I mean, not just the organ music that used to play in funeral homes, that's pretty much off the picture right now. In fact, at a funeral home service I conducted some years ago, and if you don't mind the contrast, the Grateful Dead were playing. And in fact, people are choosing all kinds of music, but it's their music. So at the last service of their lives, when they are certainly not present, at least in this earthly form, the musical choices they make are still important to them. This is their last possibility of sharing with family and friends music that has essentially made a difference in their lives. And consequently, those musical choices become extremely important to recognize and to honor. And now in funeral homes and churches and synagogues and temples, we have more ability than ever before to recreate the very special music that people loved. I'm not sure that many of you would recognize the name Arthur O'Shaughnessy. He was an English poet of Irish descent. He died in 1881. He was a prolific writer, but of his many poems, the lines that are remembered are these, the first lines of his ode from his book, Music and Moonlight. "We are the music makers, and we are the dreamers of dreams. Wandering by lone sea breakers and sitting by desolate streams, world losers and world forsakers, on whom the pale moon gleams. Yet we are the movers and shakers of the world forever, it seems." Now that has been set to music by a number of different composers, both classical, pop, and rock. But a fragment of that poem is uttered by no less a figure than Willy Wonka, played so memorably by Gene Wilder in the 1971 movie, Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory. Nasty Veruca Salt is offended by Willie's listing snozzberries as among the various fruits on his lickable wallpaper. You may not remember the scene, all right? So the lickable wallpaper simply means, as Willy Wonka says, you just lick the fruits on the wallpaper. Pineapples taste like pineapples, strawberries taste like strawberries, and snozzberries taste like snozzberries. To which Veruca replies, snozzberries? Who's ever heard of a snozzberry? And Willy Wonka's response, we are the music makers, and we are the dreamers of dreams. It is such a perfect response at that moment. We don't know if Veruca gets it or not, but we get it, we the audience, because whatever our errors, flaws, shortcomings, and failures, however much we may despair of our politics, become despondent about health care and crime, and maybe even our own cash flow, those words come back to us as who we really are, who we have been through the centuries, who we are in all different kinds of societies and cultures. We are the music makers, and we are the dreamers of dreams.